The story begins in 1900 and takes us back to an almost forgotten world. The world in which my great-grandmother, Queen Victoria, ruled over the British Empire as Queen Empress to Windsor. My mother was Queen Victoria's granddaughter. Her name was also Victoria. She was born in Windsor Castle in the great central room of the Lancaster Tower. This is where I was born, Frogmore House in Windsor Great Park, just a few hundred yards from the castle. I was born in the 63rd year of Queen Victoria's reign, on the 25th of June, 1900. I was the youngest of four children. My sister Alice, Prince Philip's mother, was already 15 years old. My sister Louise, later to become the Queen of Sweden, was 11, and my brother Georgie, nearly 8. Queen Victoria was always very particular about the names of her descendants. When I was born, she wrote to my mother, very difficult writing, but she was 81. "There's one thing which would give me great pleasure if you and Louis approve of it, viz., if you would add the name Albert to the four others." So I was christened Louis Francis Albert Victor Nicholas. But all my life, people have called me Dickie. It was obviously a tremendous thing to be one of Queen Victoria's descendants. A distinguished historian has said, "They filled, or were about to fill, the thrones of Europe. The imperial thrones of Russia and Germany, the kingdoms of Greece, Romania, Norway, Sweden, and Spain, and a number of the minor thrones inside the German Empire." This meant that from my earliest childhood, I had close personal links with many countries, and these led me later to take a close interest in them. World affairs were very largely family affairs. 6 months after my christening, my great-grandmother died, and the Victorian age departed with her. The Victorian age was the age of empire, and the British were proud to boast that theirs was an empire on which the sun never set. It was founded on sea power, and in 1900, when I was born, British sea power was supreme.
At Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee Review in June 1897, the Royal Navy paraded 165 fighting ships. This was a tremendous spectacle of naval might. Nobody, it seemed, could compete with this. This navy had not been challenged since Trafalgar, 92 years before. Now it was the country's protection, the guardian of trade, the sanction of the empire.
There wasn't much doubt about what I was going to do when I grew up. It was taken for granted I'd go into the navy. My father was Prince Louis of Battenberg. When I was born, he'd been in the Royal Navy for 32 years. He was a captain, and obviously going to the top. My father belonged to the progressive school of naval officers, the school headed at that time by Admiral Sir John Fisher, who initiated the great naval reforms before the First World War. Fisher called my father out and away the best man inside the Admiralty building. They served together in the Mediterranean, where my father commanded the battleship Implacable until 1902. And it was in that same year that my father became the Director of Naval Intelligence. Of course, I was far too young to understand the work my father was doing, but I wasn't too young to appreciate the family naval tradition. In 1905, my brother Georgie entered the Royal Naval College at Osborne. And in 1907, my father went to Malta, a second in command of the Mediterranean Fleet. My mother took charge of my education. In fact, I didn't go to school until I was 10. I was immensely lucky in my parents. My father's interests and talents extended well beyond his profession. He was a fine musician, and he could draw and paint well. My mother was a woman of wide knowledge and culture.
The Duke of Edinburgh, Lord Mountbatten's nephew, describes this remarkable princess in these words.
He came really from a most extraordinary family background. His mother, my grandmother, was an extraordinary character, tremendously well informed, and with an ability to argue and to discuss intelligently any subject you cared to mention. She was the nearest thing to a perambulating encyclopedia that I think anybody could possibly conceive.
At the beginning of the century, the German Empire possessed the most powerful military machine in the world. Backed by vigorous industry and an expanding population, the German army outshone all others in numbers and efficiency. The German Emperor, the Kaiser, was the supreme warlord. But the Kaiser was not satisfied with this glittering state. This grandson of Queen Victoria envied her one thing, the supremacy of the Royal Navy. Germany began to build a navy. By 1906, Germany was the world's second naval power. Her fleet was modern, its equipment first class. Gunnery, training, personnel were excellent. The threat was evident. A direct threat not just to the Royal Navy, but to Britain herself.
It was in 1904, when my father was still Director of Naval Intelligence, that Lord Fisher came back to the Admiralty, prepared the fleet for war, war against Germany, which he was sure was coming. He started long-range battle practice at last. Gunnery improved out of recognition. Fisher put the Naval Reserve on a sound footing and created the Reserve Fleet. He scrapped 154 obsolete ships. 50 years later, I got some idea of what that means. And finally, he concentrated the fleet at strategic points, specifically to face the German threat.
Now, all shipbuilding nations competed on practically level terms. The naval race against Germany gained a fearful momentum. The powers of Europe talked of disarmament, but everywhere arms were multiplying and alignments were being formed. In 1903, King Edward VII visited Paris and prepared the way for friendship between Britain and France, the Entente Cordiale. In 1907, Britain reached agreement with Russia, and now the alignments of Europe hardened into a dangerous pattern. Britain, France, and Russia against the triple alliance of Germany, Austria-Hungary, and Italy. The pace of crisis quickened. King Edward VII died in May 1910. 9 crowned heads followed the king's hearse, prominent among them the German Kaiser, beside his cousin, the new King George V. The Kaiser's gesture proved to be the last flicker of friendship between Britain and Germany. Scarcely had George V mounted his throne than a frightening gap in defense preparations was revealed. In 1911, the Agadir crisis made war with Germany seem an immediate prospect. The army's plan was to fight beside the French, but now it turned out that the Navy had no war plan at all. Fisher carried plans in his head, and Fisher had retired. Fortunately, the crisis evaporated, but the government was deeply shocked, and important changes followed at the Admiralty.
Winston Churchill first came in October 1911 to clear up the mess that had been revealed in the Agadir crisis. My father came back to the Admiralty 2 months later, Second Sea Lord, and triggered off many of the new personnel reforms. But Churchill's chief task was to set up at last a real naval staff to prepare strategic plans and to integrate them with the War Office so that we should never find ourselves in such a ridiculous position again. Winston would sometimes walk home with my father after the day's work, and that's how I first came to know him. He was very good with young people, very friendly. He would talk to one as though one were grown up. He certainly flattered the Dovecots as First Lord. He upset a great many people, but his achievements were great. During his first 18 months, he spent 182 days at sea, something no First Lord had ever done before or since. He improved lower deck conditions, increased the prospects of promotion to commissioned rank, and brought forward younger officers. My father became the first Sea Lord in December 1912, and together he and Winston started a naval war staff. But without a doubt, the most important thing that Winston and my father did together was their decision not to hold the normal annual maneuvers in 1914. Instead, they decided to have a test mobilization of the reserve fleet to discover just how effective our plans were for bringing the Navy quickly up to strength in time of war. The test mobilization took place in July 1914 and worked without a hitch. I was in the Navy now myself. I'd entered the Royal Naval College at Osborne the year before, and to our intense excitement, we cadets were mobilized too. I was sent to my brother's ship, the battlecruiser New Zealand. After the test, the whole fleet assembled at Spithead for the Royal Review, and I had a grandstand seat. It was a wonderful spectacle, a sort of grand climax of 200 years of British naval supremacy. King George V in the Royal Yacht Victoria and Albert passed in review 40 miles of ships, manned by 70,000 men. There were 59 battleships, 24 of them dreadnoughts. There were 78 destroyers, 16 submarines, and a large number of minor craft. None of us could know that this whole tremendous organization of naval might was going to be put immediately to the test. Because all the time the King was reviewing his fleet at Spithead, the international situation was building up to the final crisis.
Now, across the narrow seas, the alignments of Europe came to their fruition. Austria menaced Serbia. Serbia turned to Russia for support. Austria leaned on Germany. But Germany could only help by attacking France through Belgium. Outside Buckingham Palace on August the 4th, 1914, Britain cheered her entry into war with Germany. For the King and his family, for the Battenbergs, for all the nation, this was a watershed. The Great War had begun. Inside the Admiralty, a heavy burden fell on the first Sea Lord, Prince Louis of Battenberg.
It was on July the 26th, 1914, that he took the most momentous decision of his life. It was a Sunday. The First Lord, the Prime Minister, the Foreign Secretary, in fact, I believe most of the Cabinet, had gone away for the weekend. The next day, the men who'd been called up for the test mobilization were due to be paid off and the fleet dispersed. From a position of unparalleled naval strength and preparedness, the country would pass overnight into a state of unpreparedness. On the other hand, not to demobilize on the advertised date could be construed as an act of war and might make the international situation even worse. It was a fearful decision to have to take, and I remember my father telling me he'd had to take it absolutely alone. He decided not to demobilize. He wrote out the telegrams in his own hand, ordering the fleet to stand fast. 2 days later, a signal went out from the Admiralty. Tomorrow, Wednesday, the first fleet is to leave Portland for Scarpa Flow. Destination is to be kept secret. Winston Churchill wrote, "We may now picture this great fleet with its flotillas and cruisers steaming slowly out of Portland Harbor, squadron by squadron. Scores of gigantic castles of steel wending their way across the misty, shining sea like giants bowed in anxious thought. We may picture them again as darkness fell, 18 miles of warships running at high speed and in absolute blackness through the narrow straits, bearing with them into the broad waters of the north the safeguard of considerable affairs. The King's ships were at sea." And so, when Britain found herself at war on August the 4th, 1914, my father was able to report to the king we had the drawn sword in our hand.
It was widely believed in 1914 that the German fleet would immediately spring out from its bases across the North Sea and offer battle to the British. It did nothing of the kind. The young, proud German navy, built to challenge England, remained in harbour. As days of inaction passed into weeks, then months, the Royal Navy and the country at large felt cheated. It was hard to understand this style of war. The public mood was ugly in 1914. All over the country there were invasion scares and spy panics. Anti-German feeling ran high and turned against Germans and Austrians who lived in Britain.
Public figures were attacked. Lord Haldane, the great war minister who had reformed the army, was accused of being pro-German and hounded out of public life. They attacked my father because of our German name. One paper even carried an attack on my father on one page, and on another page, a glowing report of the first death in action of a member of the royal family, his nephew, Prince Maurice of Battenberg, killed at Ypres, fighting in the 60th, the King's Royal Rifle Corps. My father came to the conclusion that these attacks on him were damaging to the Navy. On October the 29th, he resigned his position as First Sea Lord, and the government, under duress, accepted his resignation. It was all so stupid. My father had been in the Royal Navy for 46 years. He was completely identified with England, and we always regarded ourselves as an English family. We were well aware of our German connections, of course. How could we not be? We're a very old family, and proud of it. I believe I can trace us back through 44 generations to the 6th century AD. I know I can trace our line back to the 9th century, to Charlemagne, in fact.
On the day of Prince Louis's resignation, Turkey came into the war on Germany's side and opened up new strategic prospects for British sea power. If Turkey could be knocked out, the Allies would be able to open the Dardanelles Straits and a direct, ice-free line of communication with Russia. Western war material could be poured in to sustain the hard-pressed Russian armies. Perhaps even a new joint front against Germany might be established. Glittering prospects, romantic place names, Constantinople, the Golden Horn. To no one did they appeal more forcibly than to Winston Churchill, first Lord of the Admiralty. Churchill's mind conceived the Gallipoli expedition.
Gallipoli is one of the large ifs of history. Well, we all know the result. Severe losses on some of the beaches, the sea stained red with blood for 50 yards out from the shore. Then a long drawn out costly campaign ending in failure. It cost Winston Churchill his office of First Lord. It lost British sea power the chance to intervene decisively, because nothing like this was ever tried again. And 25 years later, when Churchill set up a combined operations headquarters, of which I was to become chief, the ghosts of Gallipoli still haunted us.
After Gallipoli, the strength of the British Empire was poured into France. Australians, New Zealanders, Canadians and South Africans gathered on the Western Front. The British Expeditionary Force grew to nearly 1.5 million men. Nothing like this had ever been seen in British history. Hundreds of heavy guns, thousands of field guns, vast quantities of ammunition were assembled. Division upon division of fresh troops underlined the fact that for the first time, Britain was preparing to take the leading role in a major continental war. As though to emphasize this historic tide mark, now at last came the long-awaited contest of the two great fleets. The German Navy passed to the offensive. This was the moment for which the German fleet had been constructed. This was the moment the Royal Navy had been waiting for, ever since the Fisher reforms. Beatty's battle cruisers from Rosyth, Jellicoe's grand fleet from Scarpa Flow, steamed out to meet the challenge. The clash came on May the 31st, 1916. 259 British and German warships met and grappled in the North Sea. The Battle of Jutland. Bad visibility and bad communications hampered the British fleet. The issue of a murky day was curiously enigmatic. The British lost 14 ships, the Germans 11. And the Navy failed to destroy the German fleet, as all Britain expected it to do. But the Germans also failed in their intention to cripple the British fleet, and they never sought battle again.
I'd just turned 16 when I joined HMS Lahn as a midshipman. In some respects, conditions weren't very different from those of Nelson's days. On Sunday mornings, we used to be called at 4 a.m. We had to scrub out the mess, polish the bright work, and get everything shipshape. One of my jobs was to look after the leather settees. On one occasion, when I failed to get one of the seams sewn up, I got beaten. That was the traditional gunroom treatment of midshipmen, or snotties, as we were called. Barbaric, I suppose, but we expected it.
In 1916, the war at sea took a sinister turn. In October, German submarines, U-boats, sank 352,000 tons of Allied shipping. A rising curve on the graph spelt out danger in the clearest terms for an island power. The anti-U-boat campaign was intensified, and Admiral Jellicoe was appointed first Sea Lord to tackle the problem. His successor in command of the Grand Fleet was Admiral Beatty. In January 1917, Midshipman Battenberg joined the Grand Fleet in Beatty's new flagship HMS Queen Elizabeth. The Grand Fleet awaited the enemy who never came, awaited also new ammunition and new equipment which Jutland had shown to be needed, and began to absorb the lessons of Jutland. In France, the Battle of the Somme had begun on July the 1st. Now it slowed to a stop amid the mud, the ice, and the blizzards of a bad November. British Army casualties reached 415,000 in this battle. By the end of 1916, Britain had become a land power indeed and was learning the price of that condition. In 1917, the mood of the British people became embittered. Heavy casualties in the field brought this war home as none had ever come before. Air raids by Zeppelins and bombers destroyed the last illusion of island security. Unrestricted U-boat warfare brought rationing and privation. In 1917, conscription came in. Conscription for the army, conscription of labor, mobilization of women. And there was no sign of peace. In 1917, the British hardened their hearts and turned with increased anger against anyone, anyone at all, who seemed to be connected with the enemy.
Once more, people were in a state of hysteria, and the government felt they had to make some concession to it. In July 1917, the Prime Minister, Mr. Lloyd George, advised King George V that the royal family should take British names. The King's family took the name of Windsor. Queen Mary's family name had been Tech. That was changed to Cambridge. And my father changed our name from Battenberg to Mountbatten. And the King conferred on him the title of Marquis of Milford Haven. It was all rather ludicrous, really. I'd been born in England. I felt completely English. Having an English name didn't make me any more English, but that was the mood of the times. So now I was Midshipman Lord Louis Mountbatten. And I suppose the Mountbatten story can be said to begin at this point, July 1917, the fourth year of the Great War.
Imperial Russia had had a terrible war. Loyally supporting her Western allies in 1914, her unready armies invaded East Prussia. They met shattering defeat at Tannenberg. Yet in 1916, Russia revived, and a brilliant offensive inflicted irreparable damage on the Empire of Austria-Hungary. But the cost was crippling. The hard winter of 1916-1917 brought the Russian people to breaking point. The defeats of the army were defeats of the imperial regime. In 1915, the Tsar Nicholas II made himself commander-in-chief of the army. Now he was directly blamed for all its failures. And with the Tsar's headquarters, it was the Tsarina who effectively ruled Russia. The Empress was not popular. She was believed to have German sympathies. She was known to be a firm believer in absolute autocracy. And she was a mystic, deeply under the influence of the corrupt monk Rasputin. By 1917, the imperial family had become the focus of the disappointments and anger of the Russian people. A bread riot in Petrograd in March turned instantly into revolution. Within a week, the Tsar had abdicated. 300 years of Romanov rule had suddenly crashed in ruin.
The Tsar was my father's first cousin. The Tsarina was my aunt, my mother's sister. Another of her sisters, my aunt Elizabeth, had married the Grand Duke Serge. So our Russian connections were very close. We used to see our relations quite often, either in Germany or on visits to Russia. I loved Russia, and I was very, very fond of my Russian cousins. My little cousin Alexei was heir to the throne. He was about 4 years younger than me and had very poor health. In fact, he was a hemophilic, which was a great worry. His four sisters, the Grand Duchesses Olga, Marie, Anastasia, and Tatiana, were very, very attractive. I remember I always secretly hoped to marry Marie. My uncle had lost his throne. He and my aunt and all my cousins were under arrest. We were shocked and dismayed, but we didn't dream of the terrible things which were yet to come.